WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, January 22nd. Just hours into his second term on Monday, President Donald Trump signed 78 executive orders and memorandums, declaring a national emergency at the southern border, taking the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organization, issuing thousands of pardons, and revoking all of Joe Biden's last-minute executive orders. That means, among others, that Cuba's existence off the U.S. State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism lasted less than a week. With that, all the financial sanctions are back in place that critics say prompt economic disarray and massive migration of Cubans to the United States. Among the 1,500 people pardoned by Trump is the Manatee County man known for carrying the House Speaker's lectern in the Capitol Rotunda during the January 6th insurrection. The Bradenton Journal blog reported that Adam Christian Johnson posted on social media he was on his way to Las Vegas, presumably to celebrate. Without any public debate, the South Florida Water Management District removed a legal barrier standing in the way of a limestone strip mine the sugar industry wants to open. That's according to the Seeker journalist Jason Garcia. The 13-square-mile rock mine would open south of Lake Okeechobee on land that was once part of the famed River of Grass. According to Seeking Rents, the initial draft of the letter was given to the Water Management District by an executive of the construction company hired to build the rock mine and originally written by a U.S. Sugar Corporation executive. The wet cold front moving through our area today will be followed by a second drier cold front later this week, bringing freezing temperatures and possibly frost to Manatee County. Saturday is expected to be the coldest day this week. The expected low for Sarasota County on Saturday morning is 34 degrees with a wind chill of 28 degrees. Cold shelters are open at the 100 Church in Northport and the Salvation Army near downtown Sarasota. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January.
Good morning. The Peace and Justice Report. We're here every Wednesday from 9 until 10. Bob Connors and I alternate weeks, and it's opinions you hear on the show are our own, are those of our guests, and not necessarily those of the WSLR board, its employees, or volunteers. Thanks to Jesse Coleman, our general manager, who set me up on the bit because she's under the weather. And I have one announcement of an event coming up tomorrow night. Dan Boxer of the Boxer Diversity Initiative asked me to talk about an event tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Unit 75 Fruit. He writes that, as you know, the civil rights movement was a watershed in the United States history, inspired movements, including those advocating for Hispanic, Latinx, elderly lights, and its legacy grassroots organizing has led to social causes. Dr. Timothy Patrick McCarthy will provide a historical context on the evolution of these movements tomorrow night, followed by Zaya, Xander Moritz, and Kelsey Wilson. That's tomorrow night again at 6 o'clock at the Unitarian Church. Let me move this mic around a little bit so I can see here. Our guest this morning is a returning guest, is Dr. Philip Travis. Phil has been on the Peace and Justice Report several times. Phil holds a PhD from Washington State University and is a professor of history at State College of Florida, Sarasota Manatee. His publications include the 2017 monograph Reagan's War on Terrorism in Nicaragua, the Outlaw State, along with several other peer-reviewed journal articles and chapters related to U.S. interventionism in Central America, terrorism, emergency. And Phil, you just told me you have one more One more honor you just received?
Yeah, it's and thank you for having me. It's great to be back in the studio here.
It is.
I was recently appointed to the Manatee County Board for Historic Preservation, so I'll be serving in that capacity. We haven't had our first meeting yet, but I'm serving in that capacity until, I think, 2028.
What does that board do? What's the work involved?
Well, I'm learning right now, but basically evaluating the historical landmarks and sites within Manatee County and taking steps to ensure that we not only recognize them, but preserve those places. So, but again, I have my first introductory meeting coming up in just a couple of days, and I'll know more then because the appointment just occurred. But pretty exciting to be serving local history, public history for the local community. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, and by the way, there's the Unitarian Church put a marker, historical marker, in their front yard on Bee Ridge Road about the lynchings over the past 100 years in Manatee and Sarasota County. And so if you go to the Unitarian Church, be sure to check out that monitor, marker. So Phil, you said you would like to talk today about something you know a lot about, a historic peace agreement between five countries and the man who brought it all together and received a Nobel Prize for it. Go ahead and tell us about it.
Yeah, so, and anybody who wants to come to the SCF campus on the main campus in Bradenton, I'll be presenting this as part of the SCF faculty lecture series as well on March the 11th at 2 p.m., and that's in the Probstfeld Library. Now, that talk will be more of a student-focused talk, and if any of our community members want to come, there will be a Q&A at the end if you want to talk a little bit about Ronald Reagan and these types of things. Yeah. But it's the same topic, and so this is based on an article that I wrote following an interview with the president or former president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias Sanchez, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in creating the landmark Peace of Esquipulas, or the Treaty of Esquipulas. And I bet most of your listeners probably don't know what that is. So
no.
I'll talk a little bit about some background on this. But in short, this was the peace agreement that created the framework that led to the end of the U.S. Contra war against Nicaragua, and also created a path, brutal El Salvadoran civil war. This was the second. I'll talk a little bit about the peace process here in a moment. But this agreement, which was formally agreed to in the summer of 1987 between the five Central American leaders, that was Vincio Cerezo of Guatemala, Ascona de Oya of Honduras, Napoleon Duarte of El Salvador, Oscar Arias, of course, of Costa Rica, and obviously Daniel Ortega from Nicaragua. This is a landmark Cold War peace agreement. We're talking about an agreement here that not only brought an end to wars that I think that Americans probably don't really understand how devastating these conflicts were. The El Salvadoran Civil War, for example, which raged throughout the 1980s, it resulted in some 75,000 civilians dead.
Wow.
The vast majority of that, according to the United Nations Truth Commission, was perpetrated by the state of El Salvador, which was strongly supported by the United States under Ronald Reagan. And the Nicaraguan War, which if you include both the Nicaraguan Revolution of 1978 and 79, and then you carry it through the U.S.-Contra War, you're also talking about deaths that are approximately 100,000. These are what would be called irregular wars. So there's a lot of violence against civilians, sexual violence, as well as combat. And so the actual numbers are sometimes hard to be exact on. But these are incredibly brutal conflicts. And what made this such a landmark agreement was this is an example of a peace agreement in the Cold War where a small Central America does not have a military.
Right. Amazing.
Yeah. And they managed, under the leadership of Oscar Arias, to create a peace agreement that ran counter to the will of the most powerful country in the region, which was the United States. For those who don't know the background of these conflicts, and you know, maybe an opportunity to talk about some differences in how American presidents approached this conflict before we get into the nature of this agreement. The Nicaraguan Revolution under the Sandinistas began in 1978, the El Salvadoran Civil War in 1980. And in both of those cases, Jimmy Carter as president was very wary to continue funding or perpetuating human rights abuses.
Yeah.
And so in Nicaragua, the Somoza family, and in Nicaragua and also in El Salvador in the 1970s, the conditions under authoritarian rule for the people had become very, very bad. And this led to ultimately revolutionary violence in both places. Now, in Nicaragua, the FSLN or the Sandinistas would ultimately, led by folks like Daniel Ortega, would ultimately succeed in ousting the government of Somoza. And this was not exactly the intended result of Carter, it should be noted. Carter had cut aid off from the Somoza regime amid human rights abuses, but they hoped they could control the path. It wasn't, they did not want to see the Sandinistas succeed. But ultimately, they do succeed, the Sandinistas do, and the Carter administration was ready to accept them as normal players, if you will, in the regional community and as an international player in the world, albeit somewhat grudgingly. That changes, of course, with the election and inauguration of Ronald Reagan, who very much sees a military solution as the way forward in Nicaragua. El Salvador in 1980, when that war began, the Carter administration too began to rescind aid to El Salvador, given the really atrocious human rights abuses that include things like the murder of four church women, the rape and murder of four church women, action of almost unthinkable violence against civilians in that conflict. I don't want to just keep talking because I could talk about this subject. So to fast forward, when we get to the Reagan administration looks at the situation, and it must be understood that the context here is the Cold War. And for anyone who knows about the Reagan administration and the Cold War, you know that Reagan's particularly his first term as president, kind of witnessed a reigniting of the Cold War. In the 1970s, under Nixon, there was a period sometimes called détente. Nixon created this positive relationship with Leonid Brezhnev in the Soviet Union. They opened the door with communist China, and they recognized China. And so the United States in the 1970s, from the beginning of Richard Nixon's second term, the end of the Vietnam War, through Jimmy Carter, was this sort of lull in the Cold War. But by the time you get to the end of the 1970s, you get to the moments where you have the Nicaraguan Revolution, the El Salvadoran Civil War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, you start to see a reigniting of the Cold War. And the Reagan administration really approached the Cold War in a more traditional way, I suppose, focusing more on, I mean, it's a departure from the containment policy. I don't want to get too deep into that, but you see a much more a reignited Cold War. Yet again, concerns about missiles in Europe and conflicts of the world seem to be relevant. And so my point with saying that is Nicaragua aligned itself with the Soviet Union. Once it was very apparent that a meaningful path forward with the United States was not something that the Reagan administration's diplomats were really interested in, Nicaragua, and perhaps this happens anyway, but Nicaragua turns to the Soviet Union. And the Reagan administration from day one was really seeking to alter the government of Nicaragua. And it largely fashioned Nicaragua as the coming of another Cuba in the Americas. And so during Reagan's first term, Nicaragua is sort of postured as this regional threat, a second Cuba in the Americas. And that becomes sort of a motivation for the Reagan administration to use actions to eventually, as they hope, to alter the government of Nicaragua. The primary claim that they were like a Cuba in the region, of course, was based on the idea that the Sandinistas were the most overt supporter of the FMLN, which was the Farabundo Marti Liberation Front, which was the revolutionary movement in El Salvador. And so the Reagan administration says, aha, the Sandinistas support this revolutionary insurgency in El Salvador. We oppose the Sandinistas to prevent that because they're going to topple El Salvador in this civil war, which is another American-centric country. So that's like the brief background of this situation. And as you move forward, you're going to have the involvement of the United States, which I can talk about in a little bit. The United States becomes involved in a clandestine way across the Americas. You have the mining of harbors. You have the training. It was supposed to be secret, but it was not a so secret war in the 1980s. But in the 1980s, in the first term of Reagan of the Reagan administration, it was not. It was not something that Congress was formally authorizing support for the Contras. And so the United States went through. The Contras were a revolutionary group. They operated in violation of the sovereignty of Honduras, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua, largely made up of remnants of the old military, the Guardia Nacional of the Nicaraguan government. And the United States was funding and supporting them, giving them arms, their CIA, they're training them, and they were making sort of low-level conflict in border regions of Nicaragua, hoping to use military pressure to alter the government of Nicaragua. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about Esquipulas. Let's talk about what is really happening when you come to peace in this region. The Reagan administration's policy in the region was largely centered on the idea that you would align the four democratic states. This was Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, and El Salvador. You would align these states together and in support of the United States' approach in the region. And the United States' approach in the region was to use military pressure to, they would say, democratize Nicaragua, the government of Nicaragua. But they want to use military pressure to alter the government of Nicaragua. And so they want the Contras incorporated in the election process. They want the Contras incorporated into the governing process. And they want to use a sort of thorough sort of support in the region for military measures to achieve this. At the outset of Reagan's second term, there had already been one peace initiative, and this was the Contadora talks. And the Contadora talking countries, and it largely failed. It's named for its location in Panama. The Central American countries and their interests weren't. After Contadora failed, in 1986, the United States sent Ambassador Philip Habib to the region. And Habib's goal was the framework for peace that I just described, which was the idea he went around, he met with the leaders of the Central American countries, and basically was trying to get them to openly support the U.S. policy in the region, which was a use of military force through particularly the Contras, this paramilitary insurgency, which, again, the Contras, the remnants of the old Nicaraguan government's military. Nicaragua has now, it's led by Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas. It's taken a course towards support from the Soviet Union. It's being defined in the context of the Cold War as the next Cuba. And so the United States is sort of arming through these irregular channels these guerrillas, which they called the Contras. They were really a collection of different groups that had a lot of difference. But they were arming them to try to pressure. It's a form of regime change, but this is before the Bush Doctrine. This is before the United States was willing to take overt sort of level to try to alter. And so the Habib mission was partially successful. This is in 1986. And Philip Habib, and this is in the context, while this is all happening, the Reagan administration is using provocation to try to justify congressional support for the Contras. What do I mean by that? So as the Habib negotiations or talks with the Central American leaders, as that's kind of occurring in the background, the United States is conducting military exercises. It has joint exercises being conducted in border regions of Honduras, for example. And from my research, you're never going to find a primary source document where a person in the government says, we were trying to incite violence, we're trying to incite. But it's fairly clear that this was what these provocations were about. And as this is happening, it so happens that Nicaragua would invade border regions of Honduras, attacking the Contras, undoubtedly provoked by this increasing militarization around the border, these combined Honduran-U.S. military drills that were designed to mimic an invasion. And so this leads, actually, in 1986 to the U.S. Congress authorizing formally lethal aid and support to the Contras, which was kind of a...
I thought it was unauthorized, so Reagan had to go to the Iran undercover deal. So it's authorized.
So during Reagan's first term and into 1985, all of the sort of funding for the Contras occurred through back channels. It was not formally authorized under the Boland Act. Forbid doing this. Okay. Is in the second term of Reagan's administration, again, in the context of the provocation, Sandinista government attack in border regions into before Congress in 1986 and said, aha, see, this is the next Cuba in the region. You see, it's unfolding now. They're supporting the insurgents in El Salvador, and now they're attacking folks in Honduras. So you should justify funding the Contras. And it was a close vote, but actually, in 1986, Congress did affirm legitimate congressional support for the Contras. It lasts for a very brief period of time because of the revelations that lead to Iran-Contra. But yes, they did. Okay. Yeah. And so Habib goes down there and effectively works with these five or four. They're not working with Ortega, obviously, the four Central American leaders. Habib doesn't get anybody except for maybe Napoleon Duarte of El Salvador to be all-in supporters. But he does get everybody in 1986 to sort of maybe bite their teeth and agree to go along with what the United States is doing in this moment. The president of Honduras basically acknowledges that he can't speak about it publicly because of the controversy surrounding the operations that are occurring in Honduras. Arias doesn't support it, but the United States actually threatened Costa Rica with economic sanctions if he continued to move forward with a bilateral border agreement. Arias is upset because Oliver North and the United States are using Costa Rican territory to operate against Nicaragua. And so he was actually working at this time on a bilateral border agreement. He was going to work with Nicaragua. They were going to come to agreement between the two of them. I don't support this. You don't support this. We're going to agree to find a way to end this violation of Costa Rican sovereignty. The United States effectively threatened. They got very strong-armed with Costa Rica and effectively threatened economic sanctions. And so Arias pushes the bilateral agreement to the side. He still obviously is not supporting, but he agrees not to move in a overt fashion against American policy. Cerezo in Guatemala, he can't support it publicly, but supports it privately. He sort of owed something to the United States in his eye, but he also was closely tied to Mexico, and Mexico strongly opposed the U.S.-Contra war. Okay. So this is what's really happening in 1986. And this is all in the context. They had a meeting. It's called the Esquipulas One meeting. It fell apart. The Esquipulas meetings refer to the meetings that Arias organized amongst the Central American Five, all of the leaders, including Daniel Ortega. But in the context of 1986, Ortega, who feels that the United States is increasingly hostile, increasingly threatening Nicaragua, he can't agree to really the number one part of the negotiations from the Nicaraguan side, which is arms reductions. And so the first Esquipulas meeting falls apart. And this is where you have sort of a lesson with diplomacy. Diplomacy is what we should be doing first anytime we have conflicts, obviously. Obviously, military ways of solving problems in the world, we should always be turning to find diplomatic solutions and compromise. However, oftentimes diplomacy is shaped by circumstance, and some of those circumstances are circumstances brought about by players outside of the control of the major players. Success of Esquipulas II. Again, this is a landmark peace agreement. It is leadership from a country with no military in the height or the second reemergence of the Cold War. Central America, it should be noted, this is a long time this is the heart of an old American empire, right, is this region. Landmark agreement, not only because it helps to bring a path to peace to these devastating wars, but also because it witnesses a small country with no military to create an agreement that is against the will of the United States, against the will of the Reagan administration at the time, or to it. Were actually events that were outside of Arias's control. And Arias, as this is all happening, tension now, Arias speaks at the United Nations. He's talking to European leaders, United States. Arias actually more times in this window than any president had with Reagan at the time. So he's building support. Nicaragua also was successful in its case before the International Court of Justice, which found that in The Hague, that found that the United States was violating Nicaraguan sovereignty. And this increasingly starts to turn public opinion in the globe. The United States was still mixed, but in the globe, increasingly towards an isolation of the United States and in favor of Arias's position. The thing that really starts the unraveling is the beginning of what we come to know as Iran-Contra. And this unfolded, again, we were talking about the Congressional Authorization for Lethal Military Aid. Congressional Authorization for Lethal Military Aid was a very short-lived thing because in October 5th, if I remember correctly, 1986, a Fairchild C-123 Nicaragua by Nicaraguan force captives was an individual from Wisconsin known Eugene Hassenfoss. And he is paraded all over this in the employ as a privateer. He's an American. He's in the airspace of Nicaragua. He's now a prisoner of war there. Is here. This opens the door to what becomes known as the Iran-Contra investigations, which then starts to expose, fully focused on the illegal sale of arms
to Iran.
To Iran, and the proceeds then
given to the
Contras who are fighting the Sandinistas.
Yeah.
Well, when this starts to happen, the ability of the Reagan administration now to use its plan of sort of increasing military pressure on the Sandinistas until they eventually sort of cry uncle and agree to the terms of the Reagan administration, that sort of card is increasingly played. They're not really able to insist on that anymore. They're losing their leverage here. Members of Congress are starting to turn away, and they're certainly not voting to authorize more congressional military aid. Hmm. That really opens the door for Arias to undertake this landmark agreement. But it should be noted, again, diplomacy requires compromise because there are so many different parties and players, and emotions and interests are oftentimes quite conflicted. So this did not mean that it meant that Arias's peace agreement was going to be easy. And so in August of 1987, when the meeting, what becomes known as Esquipulas II, the Central American Five, including Daniel Ortega, Cerezo from Guatemala, the Honduran president, Napoleon Duarte from El Salvador, and of course, Oscar Arias, meet in Guatemala City. And in my interview with Arias, Arias is a highly educated individual, and I interviewed Arias in San Jose, Costa Rica, and I got the interview by basically reaching out to the Arias Foundation. Arias is in the spirit of winning the Nobel Peace Prize, Arias remains a real leader when it comes to peace and human rights in the world through the Arias Foundation. And Oscar Arias was kind enough to grant me an interview, which I was fortunate enough to be able to conduct in his personal residence in San Jose.
By the way, we're talking to Dr. Phil Travis, a professor of history at State College of Florida, and you're listening to WSLR, the Peace and Justice Report. And I want to remind people in Central America, in case you don't know your geography, that the isthmus between North and South America starts with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and then Nicaragua, and finally below Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and then on to Panama. So Costa Rica has Nicaragua to the north, yet it has no army, and it's negotiating this peace agreement, historic peace agreement. So keep going. Tell us more.
Yeah. So, thank you for that geography. That is, important to note, right? And that's why this idea, right? You have Nicaragua, and then to the north you have Honduras, El Salvador on the coast, not bordering Nicaragua, but very close, and then Costa Rica to the south. This is one of the reasons why the Reagan administration wanted to create this sort of support for a military sort of initiative surrounding these countries. Surrounding Nicaragua. But Arias, when they meet in Guatemala City in 1987, he was influenced by President Franklin Roosevelt, who, if anybody studies Roosevelt, knows he had, some of his own sort of nuances, but he was a very savvy political leader, and he did some things that were a little bit maybe off the cuff or maybe a little bit irregular, but he was a really savvy negotiator, a diplomat, as well as politician. And Arias said that Franklin Roosevelt, when they couldn't find agreements amongst policymakers or whatever, that they would go in, he'd lock the door, and Arias told me, he said that was basically what he had in mind. They went in and they worked through the night.
Wow.
It wasn't until it was the wee hours of the morning when they finally agreed that they would sign this agreement, which becomes the Peace of Esquipulas, which wins Oscar Arias the Nobel Peace Prize. Mm-hmm. They went into a suite in the hotel, and Arias basically like, we're not going to leave until we have an agreement here. Now, with that said, he needed concessions, right? He told me in the interview, he said, I spoke with Daniel Ortega, and he basically said, are you ready to make concessions? Now, it's important to note the situation for Nicaragua right now is different in 1987 than it was a year and a half earlier. A year and a half earlier, you really had the full sort of strength of American military pressure in the region, largely unchecked. And Ortega, during the 1986 first meeting, really did not. Now things are different. The Iran-Contra affair has really changed the situation when it comes to the use military pressure on Nicaragua. And Arias, he said to me, he said, I told Daniel Ortega, are you ready to make concessions? Knowing that if you're not ready to make concessions, then we might as well go down to the bar and have a drink, was the effective implication. But Ortega said he was ready to deal. And the group meets, and they begin hammering out this landmark deal. Now, there was one other factor here. Nicaragua was going to accept something like a 20% arms reduction, which was far lower than what the Reagan administration wanted, but it was still fairly significant. However, there was another wild card that Arias had to deal with here, and it again speaks to compromises, complexities, as well as unforeseen circumstances when it comes to diplomacy. And that was El Salvador, of all the countries, was by far the most policy. Duarte openly states his military support, or he very much supported Reagan policy. The FMLN was an insurgency that was making war in the country. They were supported by the Sandinistas, who were supported largely by places like Cuba and areas associated with the Soviet bloc. He basically says, if you're like thinking Esquipulas I, you think about the first meeting and his position going into that suite, you might immediately think that Napoleon Duarte is going to say, I can't accept this, because part of the agreement was Arius was originally suggesting that this would be a cut of military aid to all countries involved. So Napoleon Duarte says, you're asking me to basically say that I won't accept American aid anymore, but if I don't have American aid, my country could collapse if the other side keeps on doing it. Mm-hmm. So Duarte was in this really difficult position, and mm-hmm. it made the negotiations for Arius. And it's really important to make this negotiation work. It really had to be regional. All these countries had to agree, because if Duarte doesn't agree, then the FMLN is going to want to keep being supported, and then the Sandinistas might not agree because they're supporting the FMLN. So you had to have a regional five-group agreement to really make this work. Again, things occur that are maybe outside of the hands of the players in Guatemala City in 1987. Because as this is all developing, the Speaker of the House creates a plan. It's called the Wright-Reagan Plan. And the Wright-Reagan peace plan, the Speaker of the House was a Democrat from Texas. The Wright-Reagan, Jim Wright. The Wright-Reagan.
I knew him.
Yeah. the Wright-Reagan peace plan said, we will end American support for insurgents as well as governments in Central America. Well, this really upset Napoleon Duarte, because the leader of El Salvador said, you know, effectively, I don't even count. They don't even really care. They've just been using me as a pawn here, because they're willing to, without even negotiating, without even talking to him, they're willing to just cut you off for their own end. And so Duarte really felt that the Reagan administration had demonstrated a bad faith towards him. And as a result of that, he went to Arius, they're talking, and he effectively says, I will sign this if you put a clause in there that says that I don't have to refuse military aid in my country.
Okay.
And Arius makes this change, puts it in there, the exception effectively for Napoleon Duarte and El Salvador, and they sign this landmark agreement.
All five
of them signed a landmark peace agreement. And again, optically, out in front, it would have been made to appear in the United States that this was, you know, something to be celebrated. Arius went to the United States many times, but it was something that the Reagan administration did not support. And it was something that, in diplomatically, Arius was sort of playing two sides. He would go to Philip Habib, who was the ambassador, and he would say, look, this is going to fail. There's no way Ortega and Duarte are going to agree to this. Just let it fail. And there were even exchanges. You find
clever.
You even find exchanges in like the primary source documents in places like the National Security Archive at George Washington University, where Habib is distrusting him, and Arius says, you just let this fail because I know it's going to fail. He's telling them this.
Yeah.
And he jokes, or in a, you know, maybe a more of a flippant comment, that, you know, when it fails, you can just go ahead and invade Nicaragua. And Habib is reporting to the Reagan administration and saying, you know, he says he thinks it's going to fail, but I don't really think he does, because in Arius's thinking, he was on the one hand sort of, you know, sort of getting the United States to back off a little bit by telling them that he believed his plan would fail, it was not workable, while on the other side really working behind the scenes to make it work. And it's successful. It wasn't perfect per se. It still took time. There were still skirmishes in Nicaragua between Contras and in Nicaragua. It took time for the Guatemalan Civil War to end. It took time for the El Salvadoran Civil War to end. But this created a framework, and it was really the path towards that peace and that reconciliation. And again, Arius wins the Nobel Peace Prize for this.
Wow. I read his acceptance speech. It's quite eloquent. And Ortega is the only leader still in power. And so I was going to ask you, okay, so what's it like now in that region?
Well, it's interesting, and of course, it wouldn't be my specialty to necessarily speak about current Nicaraguan politics per se, but my understanding is that the sort of political approach of Daniel Ortega has changed a little bit, not as much pushing sort of the what was branded as sort of the leftism, if you will, in the 80s. Now, I will say, and this was a really interesting, I think in the interview with Arias, this was perhaps one of the more interesting things that Arias told me. And again, it's one of those things that you would only get from an individual who worked directly with Ortega. Because if you're in the United States and you hear about Arias, you hear about, well, this is the next sort of Marxist-Leninist in the region. And we were talking and Arias joked. He said, I doubt Daniel Ortega has ever read the works of Marx or Lenin. He said he's not really a leftist from an ideological sense in terms of the ideas behind it. He said, you know, he's a populist strongman.
Right.
Yeah, a populist Caudillo. And he thinks that because he won the revolution, it gives him a right to control the country. And he very much compared him to Castro in that sense.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, after the Esquipulas Agreement is signed, and of course the Cold War begins to come to an end, they had elections. That was part of the agreement. So part of the peace agreement was that Nicaragua had to agree to elections, and these elections would ultimately include folks in the Contras, that they would have to agree to arms reductions. And this is also connected to all of the parties basically forbidding support for insurgencies. The insurgencies, whether it was the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front or the Contras, were fundamental violations to sovereignty and international law. Mm-hmm. And so they agreed that they would not abet supporting those types of groups. And in Nicaragua, they agreed to have democratic elections and also arms reductions.
They did? Did they do it?
Yes, they did. And actually, it's interesting because when they have those elections, and I'm just speaking, it's been a while, but I believe the elections were in 1990. And actually, the opposition candidate, Violeta Chamorro, who was related to the assassinated leader of La Prensa, which was the Nicaraguan publication, if I remember correctly, that was assassinated at the beginning of the Sandinista Revolution, she won. Mm-hmm. But it's a brief period of time where the sort of opposition was in power, and ultimately, yes, Ortega and the Sandinista power, they come back into power. The political party comes back into power, and they remain in power in Nicaragua, albeit their policies and approach are maybe are somewhat different than you might have expected if you were looking at an Ortega in Nicaragua in the 1980s. As I understand it, there's been more appeals to sort of conservative social policy, is my understanding. But again, I'm not a political scientist on Nicaragua, so I'm reading the news just like anybody else on this. But that's my understanding of that.
Well, we have a lot of immigration exits from the area into the United States and elsewhere, and part of it's due to what, economic conditions, not great, and of course gang warfare and so forth. Talk about the current state of these five countries.
Yeah, so of course, El Salvador of these countries, I think probably in the last decade or so has probably been the one that folks in the United States, the ones who are paying at all attention to the Americas, is probably the one that has been paid attention to the most because of extreme gang violence.
Okay.
Yeah, San Salvador murder rates. And now this has opened another door of controversy and discussion about where is the line between democracy and liberal traditions and security, and where is the line crossed? Because in recent years, of course, the current government of El Salvador has basically enacted a policy, an aggressive policy against any associated with gang violence. And to be clear, San Salvador for years was regarded as easily the most dangerous city.
Oh.
Not at war, in terms of murder rate, measured murder rate of murders per 100,000. It was regularly, I don't know where it is right now as I speak. But so effectively, the current leadership in El Salvador is undertaking really mass arrests of any of those who are associated with gang violence. The issue there, of course, is you're arresting people. You're arresting so many that the justice system doesn't have the ability to, like, try all of them. Many of them don't have something that some of it could be based on hearsay. And there mm-hmm. So there have been real concerns that you could be arresting innocent or arresting people without due process. But then there's the other side of the voice, which is the country's safer now. Mm. Violence in El Salvador, you know, you're talking about a brutal civil war. And, you know, that has created disruptions in society that has led to long-term inequities. Of course, there was also deportations from the United States of groups that in the 80s during the Reagan administration that had formed gangs in the United States that were deported to El Salvador.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, who then brought gang violence there, not to say that that would be the only explanation for that. But yeah, there's a great deal of organized crime violence in the Americas. And Costa Rica remains probably – they're probably regarded, along with Panama, probably the most stable and welcoming country. Again, a country with no military. They're a popular region for ecotourism. They've done very good with environmental tourism. It's a very popular place. Doesn't mean that you should not be I went in talking to President Arias. He mentioned, he was like, people, you could get your bag stolen, right?
Right.
You could, if you leave your car unlocked or something, of course. You know, you could get something stolen from you. Because, but he said proudly, he's like, my people are not violent people, though. They will not.
Wow.
It's physical violence. And I think having traveled to the region, I think he's right about that. Costa Rica, is a relatively safe place compared to some of the other countries in the region, but there are still a lot of government failures, significant socioeconomic problems, and these socioeconomic problems and these issues undoubtedly are linked to a long history of interventionism in the region.
Yeah.
And you know, I think I would also add, just so people kind of understand this, it's not only the context of Oscar Arias creating a peace agreement sort of against the will of the United States in the height of the Cold War or the late Cold War,
right.
Which is itself really, really sort of unprecedented.
Is there any other you could think of that's like
– not off the top of my head. I was thinking about that coming here. And now I'm not a specialist on every area, but not off the top of my head.
Okay.
But it's also – you're talking about – mm-hmm. where Central America, being more than anywhere else, where these areas were, it was basically, you know, the Monroe Doctrine. This was an era under the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. These areas were imperial influence.
Right.
They weren't colonial areas. But, I mean, Nicaragua, the United States had Marines in Nicaragua for two decades, effectively, in the early 20th century. It was a regular accepted thing by the United States, Nicaragua, or other areas in the region, that if they fell outside of the ideals of the United States when it comes to what the United States wants politically and economically, the United States reserved the right to intervene in these places. And so you put it in the context of that, having a country basically control the negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
Really landmark development and a major reason why Oscar Arias Sanchez received the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on the Peace of Esquipulas. And I think it's a real testament to how difficult peace agreements can be, but also how right circumstances to bring players to the table and hopefully create a path for a better world.
Well, we have a new president now who's talking about re-owning Panama. You know, are taking it over. So we still have a feeling that we own the Central America, and we really don't. Any predictions for that area? Or I know it's hard. You can't predict what will happen down there, but is there anything the United States could be doing to lessen, for more aid, for instance, to aid in any poverty or things that cause people to head north, the gang violence? Is there any way we could help remedy some of these things? I don't know. We have a lot of money.
I definitely think there's more that the United States could do to try to improve the conditions in those areas. I wonder, and this is just complete speculation, it'll be interesting how the approach of El Salvador will play out long term. Every year, there's a conference in St. Petersburg. It's the St. Pete Conference on World Affairs. I'm a regular attendant of the conference. And last year, they were talking about this particularly. And that is, you know, what's the end game for what happens in El Salvador? You have these people, they're put into prisons, and the completely overwhelms the justice system. You can't give all these people timely trials, right?
Right.
So, but then on the other hand, it's creating, for many people, it's not highly unpopular because it's creating a safer place. So it's going to be interesting how that plays out and whether or not other places seek to model that approach, and then how we think about, like, liberal human rights, your individual liberties and these types of things, and where the line between security is at and where it's crossed.
So El Salvador basically saying, let's put all the bad guys in jail, keep them off the street. That's one approach. And are there also drug problems in these countries, or is it just our country?
Well, of course, the trafficking issues
are
huge. That's a central part of a lot of the gang violence. I think is probably depending on the place, but usually you find drug trafficking in these types of things inherently intertwined with of gang industry, I guess you would say, right?
Well, I think it's amazing that Costa Rica, I had forgotten or never knew that they do not have an army. You would think, oh, from weakness, right? They don't have an army. But through moral power, right, and vision, Arias made this happen, got these five people together. I think there was one meeting where he said, we're not losing. We're not leaving. What a guy. And he's still around. He's still alive. He's 84,
yep.
Of course. But Ortega is still there, head of Nicaragua. So in general, I think, given there is five, those five nations, I think, could be worse.
Yeah, Arias, too, in interviewing Arias, very, very humble and open and welcoming individual. And it was really, I in the process of doing research and these types of things, you're often reaching out to people who are, you know, you reach out for an interview and you say, well, you know, why would they accept an interview from myself, you know? And a lot of times people, you know, you get a lot of refusals. But Arias, it was not hard to get the interview. And I'll go on. When I do the lecture series, again, State College of Florida, March the 11th at 2 p.m. at the Carol Probstfeld Library, we'll be holding a talk on the lecture series. And they do all kinds of excellent talks. Faculty members like Robert Scholler, Miguel Benitez are the leadership there at SCF. But this, we'll be doing a talk on this, really, as well as members of the community. We'll really find there's some really interesting sort of backstories about meeting Arias. I think folks will find really fun, really interesting. There's some talk about today, which is perfect. I wanted this to kind of be like this so we could prep it for that talk too.
Right.
So if you're able to come to
a week before, so I can mention it on the air. Maybe we'll get more people there. And the more we learn about history, the more we learn things really work. I think the better citizens we are.
Yeah.
And I love history professors. I learn so much. And I was a teacher just the other day. And students coming into high school don't know as much as you might. So we'll try to improve our knowledge. And I had forgotten which nation was where in Central America. And I have a map here, and I'm memorizing it because it's part of our back. About 1 minute left here. We're talking to Phil Travis, Dr. Phil Travis, professor of history at State College of Florida in Sarasota, Manatee. Phil's been on our program before. And that's your area of specialty still, Central America, right?
Yeah. I'm working on creative nonfiction, history, fiction work. And it's my specialty as a historian, I would say, is U.S. and the world. It's the Cold War and international relations. But I've kind of a political historian, too. I've written, and I'm actually looking for an agent to work with for promoting this and publishing this. So if there's any agents out there, you... But it's about the 1980s, and it gives sort of a micro perspective while also casting the macro perspective of the Reagan administration and the big changes in America in the 1980s.
Well, anything that can give us more sense of who we are, our history, how it can give us more sense of history is good by me, and I thank you for doing it, Dr. Phil Travis. We've got about 10 seconds.